Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 152. With the title, Embracing Every Mind. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Charlie Hart. Charlie, also known as Awesome Charlie, and you'll find out in a minute why, is a neurodivergent keynote speaker championing neurodiversity and LGBTQIA plus inclusion in the workplace. And when I asked Charlie to describe their superpower, they said it is their unwavering dedication to creating a better world. Neurodivergent and queer youth, inspired by their own children and the Gen Z community. Hello, Charlie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we've talked about this for a couple of months, and I'm really honoured you've come on today.
I'm really excited to be here because I've been following your work on LinkedIn for quite a long time now. And then we met through the Professional Speaking Association, and I'm really keen to get on this fabulous podcast, which I quite often listen to when I'm on a long walk.
Oh, thank you. And this, you have the honour of being the first video version of this podcast. I mean, yes, it'll be published in audio only as well on Spotify, iTunes and these places, but this is going to be the first one we actually recorded the video as well. So yeah, I'm excited by that as well. So it's going to be brilliant.
Me too, yeah.
So Charlie, we talked about in the opening there about your work championing neurodiversity through your own experience and also ahead of your children and the Gen Z community at large. What took you from where you were to deciding this was your passion and your calling?
So it's quite a long story, as you can imagine, but my background is HR and I fell into that quite by chance. Analytical and project management side of HR and supporting the HR system, but I tried to progress and I ran into difficulties with meeting behaviours. I was frequently overwhelmed, quite often getting burnout that looked like depression. And I just wasn't getting promoted through the ranks like my peers that started at the same time were. Eventually I realised that my child, Iggy, my firstborn, was autistic and that so was I. Everything that he learned about his neurotype and the reasons that he struggled with anxiety and getting overwhelmed and having what was actually autistic meltdowns, but he thought were anxiety attacks. Everything that he realised, I realised was true about me as well. So in 2018, I went through the autism diagnosis and I discovered the neurodiversity community online. So that, to me, it really sparked my interest. After 15 years of feeling like I was somehow broken, there was something wrong with me. I realised that there was a concrete reason why I struggled with things that my peers took for granted. And there were concrete reasons that I was losing my cool and even tipping into burnout. And it explained so much about me. And then I discovered that actually neurodiversity is a thing. There are differences between each and every human brain and mind. We all process the world and its inputs. We all think, feel, and respond to things uniquely. And that doesn't mean that some people are broken and that some are good. It doesn't mean that some brains are correct and others are wrong. It's a natural part of human diversity and it's advantageous. So, like biodiversity in nature, neurological diversity in a human population, such as a workforce, is advantageous. this really sparked my curiosity. And then I found out I have complex PTSD as well, which a lot of neurodivergent people have who are late diagnosed and have gone through society and work not understanding how to support their own needs. And I also have ADHD, so I'm multiply neurodivergent. And yeah, so it's all I want to talk about and write about now. Yeah, so I quit my HR job 18 months ago, and now I full-time research, think, speak, write, create content about neurodiversity, inclusion and acceptance, and I'm loving it.
You mentioned there that we all have our own unique minds. We all see the world through our own lens and the way we think and act and feel. I've always wondered, when the human species evolved 100,000, 200,000 years ago, however we came from our prehistoric primitive backgrounds, who decided that we needed to think in a specific way? So it's almost like the 21st century, the 2025 where we are now, that said, this is what we value, these calm, cool, collected, logical people.
Yes.
Our history must have been, we needed people who had attention to detail. We needed people who were creative. We needed people who could get on with stuff, people who did all these different things. So neurodivergence really is part of our historic makeup, and we've just decided that this part is more valuable than this part.
Absolutely.
That sucks, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's this neuronormativity, this expectation that we should think and respond to things in a certain way. It is a social construct, really, like gender. So I'm drawing parallels here. If you think back to caveman times, for example, it was super important that some members of the population brought up children and that others were hunter-gatherers. But that doesn't need to be attached to gender. It's really about finding out what an individual's strengths are and what their support needs are. So some people will be super good at some things and will struggle with others. And we can work together and collaborate and be greater than the sum of our parts.
Yeah, we certainly didn't have toilets with signs on them 100,000 years ago,
no.
Did we? In the forests and caves, we were wiping our bottoms on the nearest leaf, probably, or in the stream.
Absolutely. So it's just another social construct. And one thing that a lot of people may not understand as well, even if they know a little bit about neurodiversity and neurodivergence, is that neurotypical or normal, that's a construct of the dominant culture that you're operating in. It will be completely different between different countries. And a lot of neurodiversity advocates are only seeing things through a Northern Hemisphere white Western lens. But it's far greater than that.
Yeah. You mentioned also that you were late diagnosed, and that's we bring gender into this. It's a gender thing because people who are assigned male at birth exhibit autistic ADHD neurodiversity in different ways than people assigned female at birth, don't they?
They can do, yeah. I mean, I'm not gender conforming anyway, so I partially reject that. And also, when you look through my school reports, they are full of evidence of ADHD. It's full of stuff like she's a really bright girl and could really excel if she would only fulfill her potential instead of allowing herself to be distracted by her intense hobbies and interests, things like that. And if it was a boy, it would have been picked up. So it isn't that my behaviour was different. I think it's more that the diagnostic criteria are actually based around unruly, disruptive little boys. So they don't see ADHD if it's less evident externally. They think it's about running around being hyperactive. Girls are more socially conditioned, I think, not to be disruptive at school and to sit still if they're expected to and to not heckle the teacher, although I always did. So it's just, there are massive preconceptions about what's actually going on. If the person appears to be behaving, they're not too much trouble to the teacher. Nobody takes the trouble to work out what's going on inside of their minds. If they're running 20 tabs and 10 of them are frozen, we don't know where the music's coming from and we can't stop it. Nobody sees that unless they ask us. They'll ask our teachers whether we're disruptive. They might ask our parents how we are at home, but if you're a child and you're experiencing the world in that chronically overwhelming way, nobody seems to really want to know about it.
Are you aware of what age were you? Because I appreciate the ADHD traits and the autistic traits are different.
Yeah.
And they exhibit themselves differently. And I know I've spoken to many parents of autistic children, and they're very aware from the very early ages of their child in terms of developmental differences, learning to speak and read and vocabulary and things like that. They're very hyper aware of the autistic traits. When did you become really aware of your bouncy Tigger traits, you know, your ADHD, your the way your brain was wired?
Yeah, I think it's when I started to really need, as an adult, to get outside in the countryside and run or walk. Otherwise, I wasn't okay. It's at that point that I realised that I've got a hyperactivity that nobody else had picked up on. And then the inattentive side of my ADHD, I realised I have that when I tried to repeat my HR professional qualifications. So I completely flunked university when I was 19. I was a total disaster. I fell so hard off the rails. But I did do my CIPD qualifications when I was in my early 20s, moved back in with my mum. I did them. She was looking out for me. I had a steady job. Everything was okay. And I got them done. And then 20 years later, I thought I should probably do them again because they're 20 years old. They seem quite irrelevant. And I did that and I was great. I'm quite clever. I can focus, and but only if it's something I'm interested in. It's not that I don't have any attention. It's that I've got a very interest-based motivation system. So in 2021, I thought, great, we're working from home all year. Some people have returned to the office, but we were refurbishing ours. And I knew that I'd got time on my hands. I thought, I will do my postgraduate diploma in HR management. And I absolutely flew through every subject that I was interested in. And really, really struggled with the ones that I wasn't, to the extent that it was right up against the deadline and I was an absolute nightmare to live with. Just put things off and then snapped at anyone that was interrupting me. But I could tell I'd got ADHD then. My husband had just been through the diagnosis, so I knew what the questions were. And all the way along, I was thinking, yeah, me too. But then I actually got diagnosed this year at the age of 48. It's been there all along. I look through my reports and it's always been there.
It's interesting because I love talking to people who are a diverse ADHD, because I'm trying to self-diagnose myself and try and figure out if I have autistic, or probably not autistic, but certainly ADHD, because I have hyperfocus. I went through a phase when I was probably about 14 years old, probably a bit of puberty kicked in and I became completely unmanageable. At school, partially completely. So if you look at the left-hand side of my report card, I was E. Look at the right-hand side of my report card, I was A.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the middle. I was either full on or completely disinterested and troublesome.
Yeah.
That's so physics, the subject, science.
The ones you're interested in.
Yeah.
Or the ones you were
hyper
gifted.
Engaged in those, yeah. The sciences, the maths, the history, the geography. Economics, all those kind of sort of more theoretical, ethereal sort of things. Those were the kind of ones that I just was interested in.
Yes, yeah.
And I was kicked out of class and I was, I was told I was disruptive. And I think I found that, I'm still that now. I'm either in or I'm out. If I'm in, I'm both feet, I'm absorbed, I'm pulling it apart, I'm ripping it to shreds, I'm turning it inside out, putting it back together, turning it inside out again. But if it's anything else, I'm just kind of like, I procrastinate until it doesn't matter anymore. I just get rid of it. So, yeah, I've learned that about myself. I never seen it as a superpower or weakness or anything like that. It's just part of who I've always been.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't really subscribe to the superpowers versus weaknesses kind of narrative, because every human has strengths and we all have things we find harder or that we need support with. Or that we just don't like. So every human's got their own ways of working where they can thrive and things that they'd rather not be doing or that they need someone to help them through. The difference is when you're neurodivergent, it can mean that the things you're good at, you're particularly good at, and the things that you struggle with, you particularly struggle with. So rather than being a good all-rounder, you have what they call in the neurodiversity industry is a spiky profile. So my observation skills right at the top of the chart, my meeting behaviours right down the bottom, that kind of thing. And everyone has a profile that looks different, but particularly if you're autistic or ADHD, there will be things that you're shit hot at and things that you're constantly told you're not good enough at.
Yeah.
But it is from the dominant perspective, the dominant cultural perspective.
Yeah, no, I get that. Because you've met my wife, Marie. I also recognise that there's elements of her personality, which are probably through menopause have probably become more exaggerated. So I know it's due to her age, her hormone balance, other things, where she's become much more, I describe as bouncy tigger, sort of over various things. But she also has an inclination to be slightly manic and slightly reserved. So she goes through this, you can tell this cycle about certain things, and she has to go into hyper-planning mode, or she has to go into something else to absorb it.
Yeah.
And it's different to me. And I think I've learned that how to be with her and absorb the spikes and the troughs and everything else. And I guess my family have adapted to me. But yeah, it's interesting talking to other people with their experiences.
It's an interesting relationship dynamic. Yeah. And me and my husband have the same. So we're both ADHD. That is, we're both autistic and ADHD. But he's been told that his autism isn't quite meeting the diagnostic threshold, which is arbitrary anyway, let's face it. I'm not saying, I would never say everyone's on the spectrum, but you can quite often notice ADHDers who have quite significant autistic traits but wouldn't get through the diagnosis because the medical model wants us to draw the line somewhere. But he's ADHD, and everyone that knows him knows that he's autistic as well, despite what the clinicians might say. And I'm autistic, and it was a bit of a battle for me to get my ADHD recognised by the medical profession, partly because it's very easy to think, well, everything that she's talking about could be a combination of autism and complex PTSD and menopause. But yeah, I think you can't draw a neat line around the autistic part of my brain and the ADHD parts. So there's no way of knowing if I spend 10 hours doing a particular piece of work that I'm really engrossed in. There's no way of knowing whether that's me leaning into that monotropic flow state that autistic people get, which is where we get our highly focused special interests that are in the diagnostic criteria. There's no way of knowing whether it's that or whether it's the ADHD hyperfocus. If somebody says something that makes me feel like crap and I have a meltdown, there's no way of knowing if that is an autistic meltdown or if it's an ADHD emotional dysregulation thing, a rejection sensitive dysphoria reaction. I don't have two brains, it's just ADHD.
Yeah.
When you look at it like that, I don't know many people that I would say were just autistic or just ADHD. It starts to feel like it's all one spectrum.
I was speaking to a lady on this show the other day, and she was saying that her child is autistic. She has an autistic child. And it manifests itself in her child as he is nonverbal. He also has a very limited vocabulary, so that's how it manifests itself. So that's how he is developing as a nonverbal autistic child.
Yes.
How would you describe your autism? Because people listen to this show, hear the term autism, hear the term neurodiversity, hear the neurospicy, all these kind of buzzwords. What's the difference? Or where's the sort of...
So I have the kind of autism which doesn't come with intellectual disabilities, and it doesn't come with a language development delay. That used to be called Asperger's syndrome. They call it all autism spectrum disorder now. I don't identify as having a disorder, so I call myself autistic. I don't think I'm better or more valuable to society than people who are autistic and have intellectual disabilities. So I don't use terms like high functioning or low functioning either. So it's just autism. Yeah.
It's labeling people.
I'm just autistic.
What we're doing is we're saying High functioning, low functioning.
I never say I'm a person with autism because it goes without saying that I'm a person. And to me, if anyone insists on saying, no, you're not autistic, you have autism, you're a person with autism, to me, they are saying autism is a bad thing and you shouldn't make it part of your identity. And I reject that because I think it's a neutral thing and it's an adjective. So I'm happy to be described as autistic because it's an adjective. If you say, oh, no, you can't use it like a normal adjective, you have to distance yourself from it. That's telling me they think that there's something wrong with being autistic. So yeah, it just lands really ableist with me.
Yeah, I think it's probably been inherited from the physical disability community who use with, don't they, as a kind of a, it's evolved as a kind
about
of
the
language.
Community. Yeah, the healthcare professionals, it doesn't come from the community.
No, it's a medical model versus the societal model of disability.
Yeah. So if you get taught person first language, it's usually because you're in a support role or you're a diagnostician or a teacher, or it's not because that's what the community have said they wanted. Back in the 90s, you might remember we had this politically correct thing where they changed a lot of the language and dressed things up in flowery euphemisms. And it really didn't do diversity and inclusion any favours at all. And one of the first communities that came out of that saying no bollocks to all that was the deaf community. So in the politically correct 90s, when people were saying you have hearing impairments and you should say you're hard of hearing or you have a hearing impairment, don't describe yourself as deaf because there's more to you than that. You're a person. It was the deaf community that said bollocks to that, we're deaf. And they put a capital D at the beginning.
Yeah.
And became the deaf community. The autism community were hot on their tails.
Yeah. When I talk about adjectives or describing words or anything like this, like we're talking about now, is I tend to try and mix up the language. So I would always say a person with a disability or a disabled person, almost in one sentence, because I know there are some people who would identify as one and one people who identify that. So you're trying to be inclusive to cover all the terms possible.
That's a really great approach.
Yeah. I mean, capital D, deaf, is important to people who are born deaf.
Yeah. So I know other people who don't use it. I mean, I know a deaf speaker from the Speakers Collective who describes herself as deaf with a capital D, and another deaf speaker in the Professional Speaking Association who says that she has profound hearing impairments. So it's never going to be the same for everyone. Mm-hmm. But you can look at what the community ask for and want and prefer as a whole, rather than just being learning about something in a training course and thinking, oh, yeah, that must be the wishes of the community.
Yeah, you'd never say someone has seeing impairment, would you? You'd say they were blind.
Yeah.
Or hearing, or sight loss, or short-sighted, long-sighted.
Yeah.
Or myopic, or glaucoma, or something. So you'd say, you have sight loss, or you're blind, or
so
going blind.
ADHD is a funny one because there isn't really a noun, there isn't really an adjective for ADHD. So we use ADHD as an adjective sometimes and a noun. You might say, I'm an ADHDer, or describe yourself as ADHD. But that's technically not correct, because if you look at what it stands for, that's just grammatically nonsense. But still, a lot of us have done that just because we're trying to say it's part of our identity. It's part of who we are. It's how our brains are wired. So it's not something we can distance ourselves from.
I've heard people use ND for neurodiverse, or I've heard people use neurospicy, other terms.
Yeah.
But I guess it's down to them, isn't it? I mean,
it's totally down to them. I personally don't like neurospicy because I think that it's kind of one of those euphemisms that plays down our quite real disabilities and support needs. But
so trivializing, joking about it almost.
Yeah, that's the word. Yeah. But I heard from members of the global majority who've said actually some Asian women are described as spicy in a derogatory way. So it could be potentially, I don't know if problematic is going a bit too far, potentially insensitive, culturally insensitive. But then I'm not going to tell people how to identify. So if you have got someone that does like to call themselves NeuroSpicy, that's fine. But if they buy me a badge that says NeuroSpicy on it, I'm not likely to wear it.
So, I mean, the audience and you are obviously aware that I'm a transgender woman, or yes, woman with a transgender history. That, to me, and what I talk about, that's just a difference in brain development. It's just a different way of wiring up.
Absolutely.
My blue wire is connected to my red wire, not to another blue wire. So that's all it is, really.
It's a really good way of looking at it. And I mean, I think it is a neurodivergence as well. I think it's part of the neurodivergent umbrella. It's a brain wiring which is different from society's idea of typical. There's also a huge correlation. So if you're autistic, you're far, far more likely to be trans or non-binary. If you're trans or non-binary, you're way, way more likely to have at least some autistic traits, whether it's diagnosed or meeting the diagnostic threshold or not. So there's been quite a few studies done on this, and I'll send you those links for the show notes if you like. But there's a huge correlation. So this is one of the reasons why my niche, when I'm talking about neurodiversity inclusion, my thing that I get asked for more than anything is I get asked to talk about the double rainbow. And that's an intersecting identity. It's when you're both neurodivergent and LGBTQIA+. And I'm particularly interested in that because I'm multiply neurodivergent. I'm bisexual or pansexual. I don't know which, because both definitions fit me. I'm gender nonconforming. So yeah, I'm a woman, but I am also a tomboy and I don't really identify as a woman. I don't know. But I'm more like George from the Famous Five, really. So it's me, but then it's also my kids. My firstborn, Iggy, he was gay and gender questioning. He was autistic. He was probably ADHD as well, we don't know. My teenage kids constantly changing their gender identity because there's no hurry to work it out, is there? But they've had all kinds of different names and pronouns. They are autistic as well. And the older one, I mean, has got ADHD too. And I've got transgender autistic people in my family as well, but I'm not going to out them because they're not public about it. So it's a very queer and autistic family that I'm in, defying all the gender laws. So this is my area of interest. And there's really no point just looking at one identity either, because none of us is a single issue human. I think it was Audre Lorde who said that. She was a black lesbian feminist poet, and she said there's no such thing as a single issue human. And anybody that is working in the diversity and inclusion space, it's really important to understand that we are a blend of characteristics. Some of them we're born with, some of them are a response to our environment and our experiences, but we're all really complex. So kind of need to look at the whole package of the human.
Yeah, I remember in my probably my 30s and early 40s, I used to describe myself as low maintenance. I think coming out as trans, I had to rebrand myself as high maintenance.
So yeah,
maybe we all have a perception of ourselves that we are low maintenance, but actually if you start asking people around you, they go, actually no, and actually this and actually the other, and you go, oh okay. But that's part of a bit of emotional intelligence, getting in touch with who you are, isn't it?
Absolutely. Emotional intelligence, there's an interesting concept. I know a lot of people who regard themselves as having really high emotional intelligence. But to me, what I'm observing is a lot of social scripting and saying the right things with the right facial expressions, because that's what we've learned from other people. And it's like a chameleon behavior rather than an innate empathy. I've seen a lot of autistic people being misunderstood as not being empathic and having low emotional intelligence, when actually the reverse is true. So it's really quite interesting to unpick that.
Yeah, I've noticed that, because if you look at the stereotype of femininity, women are supposed to be more empathic, more empathetic, more softer, more kind, more caring. And I thought, hang on a minute, I have to be all these things, do I? Then I kind of realized that I was, and I was judging myself unfairly. I was just maybe putting a shell on myself, stopping being too caring and too empathetic, because in a male world, it doesn't necessarily win you any battles being kind, caring, compassionate.
Did you work in tech before you got into
I did IT in tech, yeah.
Yeah. So It's kind of a role where you're expected to be rational and logical and methodical and analytical and all those things. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you haven't got creativity and empathy at the same time.
I think, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier about hyper-focus, things like this, you know, when I was deep in hyper-focus on an IT problem, you know, trying to rebuild someone's server in the middle of the night, working all night in a computer data center in a freezing cold with a coat on, trying to fix something, I didn't have any brain capacity for anything other than the problem. All of this, all of the empathy, all of the human contact stuff was pushed to the edge, and I was deep in techie mode.
So I'm going to send you some resources about monotropism. So this is a theory. It links to that diagnostic criteria about the highly focused special interests that you have when you're autistic. But it's way more than that. It's about being able to put the blinkers on and have tunnel vision to the thing you're researching or the problem that you're trying to solve. And it's widely regarded as being an autistic trait rather than an ADHD one, but it looks a lot like ADHD hyperfocus. I think you'd be really interested to read that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we dismissed the idea of superpower earlier, but I always saw it as part of my technical skill is to be able to really get onto a problem. Yeah, my time in the RAF as an electronics engineer, most of that course and that training was all about fault finding. Finding faults in circuits. And I was very good at working out, you know, half splitting in the middle again, narrowing it down to sort of like a square centimeter and go, it must be that component. So I was very good at that.
Ooh,
I wasn't good at designing circuits, but I was very good at finding out what was wrong with things.
I'm not at all surprised. So my husband's doing that now. So he worked in IT for quite a long time. He's doing an occasional speaking event now and he's a musician. But his current hyperfocus is tinkering with electronic things and fixing them. So you buy a secondhand amplifier that's sold as it's a really good amp, but it's a bit broken, and then he'll fix it, teaching himself as he goes along. And he's done the same with record players and laptops and all sorts. And I think that it's a special skill to know when to keep digging, but to know when to leave it, because you're just wasting your time after a while. But when I worked in HR, and like I say, I was in an analytical role, I was supporting HR systems and projects. But I think one of the things I was particularly good at is getting to the underlying cause of the problem. So I could help people in my team pass error messages, I could find workarounds, I could teach them how to do things. But if there's duff data, I need to be able to establish where the learning need is that's causing something to be input incorrectly. If there's an error message that keeps cropping up, I need to know where in the process it's coming from, or whether there's a glitch that needs to be fixed by the system vendor. And I just don't cross it off my list until I've got to the bottom of it.
Tenacity, that dog with a bone.
Yeah.
Just keep chasing it. Yeah.
So I think that's why in IT, if you look at IT with like this kind of service model where you've got the service desk people, and then if it's something more technical that they can't fix it there and then, they will refer it to a resolver group. That resolver group quite often has a lot of autistic people that are really tenacious and excellent at problem solving. So what workplaces need to understand, employers even, is if you want the people with those skills, then you're going to have to not have neuronormative expectations on how they get through the recruitment process, what support they need in the role, what their interpersonal skills are like, and that kind of thing. You want the best person for that job, not the best person at passing an interview and getting on well with their colleagues and making the right small talk on a Monday morning.
I was at a mini conference once, and we were doing these sort of round table discussions, and we were talking about, I think it was probably culture fit or something like that came up. And there was an owner of a business there who was, I think it was technical, they were a SaaS platform, a cloud platform, something like that. And he was talking about, he basically said, I've got a couple of members of my staff, they really don't want to join in with anything we do. You know, at lunchtime when we want to go to the pub, at lunchtime when we want to have a little bit of a giggle and a laugh, all they want to do is go and take their lunch, sit in their car for an hour, and then come back. I said, I was thinking about firing them. They just don't get on. We're just not part of the team. And I thought, Blimey. Yeah, what you're doing here is what you're saying is judging people by your culture. And you know, when people don't fit into your definition of normal, then you're writing them off as being not team players. You think, hang on a minute, these are probably your best resources at writing code and problem solving. And
they're
you're
recharging
trying to
themselves.
Tell them how to think. Yeah, they are. Yeah.
They're working in an open plan office with a lot of different noise going on and people asking them things and calls coming in and they're trying to solve the problem. They've got a lot of inputs. Then if they need to spend their lunch hour without those social inputs, at least, probably without the sensory inputs as well, if they've chosen their own sensory environment that they can curate like a car, they're recharging themselves so that they can come back and be productive in the afternoon. That should be commended. It's a neuronormative expectation that they sit around and continue to do the peopling.
Yeah, I had a clash with one of my team in the past where they wanted the radio on and I couldn't stand any background hum or noise or chat or something like that. And it was like, well, like the radio just kept taking my brain off of the task. It's like, go away, leave it, just turn it off.
Yeah.
But they needed it on because that's how they thought. So it's trying to find that balance. And
quite often it is. So when you're looking at neuroinclusion in the workplace, it's quite often balancing conflicting needs. And when you do it in the home, it is as well. So I had that problem in the pandemic. I'd already been working from home a couple of days a week. So my husband was quiet on those days. But when the pandemic hit, I was working from home every day. And he liked music on and TV on at the same time. And I wanted neither. So we had to find our ways of cohabiting without wanting to kill each other. And we did. It just took a while. In the workplace, in my last HR job, I was working from home all the time. But I had a manager who didn't like to type things into a chat or send a lot of emails. She had a lot of issues with her shoulders and her wrists aching. And she wanted to just ask me things verbally like we're in a normal office. So she'd drop into Teams video calls with me like we're in an office and she was just tapping on my shoulder and saying, can you have a quick look at this? She was doing it all through the day. And I said to her, I can't work like this. It's so overwhelming. And I started to send her a lot of text messages on Teams and she was saying to me, I can't work like this. It's hurting my shoulders and my wrists. So we work together and we compromise. And that's what you've got to do.
Yeah. Our son is he's an IT techie. He was diagnosed as being dyslexic in his early teens. And he was given allowances and exams, things like that as well. But he doesn't respond to text messages. He may not even read them. He'll just say, haven't you responded? So, I don't do text. Oh, yeah. So give him a voice note or you just ring him up, he'll answer the phone, have a chat with you. But if you start texting, because the trouble is the rest of the family, we have WhatsApp groups, and what we want to do is just pop something in the WhatsApp group, are you coming around later? He doesn't respond. Is he doing it or isn't he? So you have to send him another one, which is a voice note, which he then responds to.
Yeah, we have
so just learning
similar issues. Yeah, so my kids, neither of them like making phone calls, but they're quite comfortable to chat to people online when they're gaming and they're quite comfortable to send voice notes and video notes. It took me a really long time to get used to that because I'd rather be typing. Seems a bit funny now because I've been a professional speaker for 18 months, but I communicate a lot better in the written form. They send me a voice note and I'll listen to it and I'm typing back to them while I'm listening to it.
That's what I do. Someone voice notes me, I reply back by text.
Yeah.
Because I keep my phone on silent all the time. It doesn't make a noise. It doesn't squeak. LinkedIn, whatever I'm scrolling, all the videos, if they haven't got subtitles, I'm not interested. Even though I think I've got slight dyslexia as well. Maybe it's my neurodiversity. I don't know. I find it really difficult to read vast amounts of text. I lose track. My brain wanders off halfway through a page. But I can consume two or three liners, no problem at all. One bite-sized chunk, I can do that.
Yeah.
I prefer to text, not voice notes, because I don't want to turn the volume up. It's like, you're invading my space.
I always put earphones in to listen to a voice note because I just don't want to disturb the people around me as well. But sometimes I think when we get big blocks of text that it would be easier to read it and pay attention to it if it was broken up into like you have a sentence and then a blank line and then another sentence. So these are tips that you can get off the British Dyslexia Society, I think they're called, website. They're aimed at people who are dyslexic, but it helps as well if English isn't your first language, if you've got ADHD, all kinds of things. So you tend to find most of these neuro-inclusion tips will make things better for far more people than they're intended to.
Yeah, whenever I'm writing articles and reports, I always make sure there's a good space between paragraphs.
Yeah.
I always do two spaces after a full stop to break the sentence up. I like some white amongst the black. I like it to look. And of course, all these things, I like to capitalize the first letter of titles, things like this. And everyone says, no, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't have a capital at the beginning. I don't read it that way. So, yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I know it's aesthetics as well, isn't it? It looks pleasing to you. But
that's exactly it. It's going to look nice, isn't it?
Yeah. There's some dyslexia-friendly fonts that are just not attractive at all to look at. But then there are others that are. We've been going on a lot of tangents, haven't we? I went to a Futures ND event about inclusive design in advertising and creative industry, and I picked up a lot of stuff about fonts and spacing and things. So I'm building like a mind palace of information about neuroinclusion. But a lot of times you read something and think, well, that's going to help everyone. And do you know what? That's what Gen Z want. They are the workforce of the future. And if they've got preferred ways of working, preferred hours or flexibility or media, all of these things, they're used to expressing that preference and not being told, no, you've got to work in this place from 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and do as you're told. They know how to advocate for their individual needs and preferences, and they're going to expect work to fit into their lives and not the other way around.
Yeah, that's definitely what I'm hearing. Our children are 30, so they're millennials, really. They're not really Gen Z, but even they have different traits because my background's tech. They were pretty tech included from day one. They had all the gadgets. They had phones early. They had as soon as it was available. So they weren't tech ignorant. So I suppose from the age of 10, they were pretty tech included. So yeah, but I've seen a lot of examples now talking to people of the Gen Z age group where they have a different relationship with the world because of the way they're communicating with each other.
Yeah, definitely. And all these, I don't know how topical I can be here, but this idea of the American administration and big tech companies in America abolishing DEI programs, it's so blinkered and counterproductive because those companies will die out when the workforce is made up of Gen Zs. They are going to want to be able to talk about their needs and ideas and to have those needs met. So they're not going to stand for working in a company that doesn't have that corporate social responsibility and doesn't care about human needs and individuality and being protected from discrimination and bullying and all that stuff. They're going to want more than that.
Yeah, my view is that people have latched on to the negative side of DEI initiatives rather than the positive side.
Yeah.
I think what people are trying to say is we want to stamp out the negativity around forced quotas and forced this. And I think hang on a minute, you've got to provide
not
equity.
Not many people
it's
do that
quotas.
Anyway. Yeah. They're kind of behind the times with that view because we really don't do that. I mean, a lot of people in diversity and inclusion realise that there are minority groups that unfairly experience some barriers to education, employment, progression, etc. But nobody's ever saying you can't have a job here if you're a cisgender, middle-aged, white, affluent, heterosexual man. That's just never been the case.
They shouldn't be, for sure. No, I mean,
yeah.
I always say that you can't have an inclusive environment by excluding people.
No.
And you can't exclude the typical person either. You have to include everybody in these.
So it's about breaking down those barriers rather than saying, no, we want a workforce full of people who are not that cishet white middle-class dude.
I think some of it for me comes down to defining more clearly the meritocracy because meritocracy isn't always bigger, louder, faster. Sometimes it's more, I can never say that word, empathetic. Sometimes it's about being better listening skills, more team management skills, more creativity. So some of these things are often excluded from the definition of meritocracy because they're not seen as valuable. Or they're, you know, to quote Zuckerberg, we need more masculine energy in our businesses. Actually, we need a balance of energy.
Yeah.
Not labeled masculine and feminine. We're labeling, we need to change, abandon those labels as being a neurotype, if you like, and think about the actual core skills people are bringing, and not soft skills, not hard skills. That's, again, labeling things in the wrong way.
It's been around for a long time, though, hasn't it? Yeah. We've been talking about team dynamics, and don't you know those team roles? I forget what they're called now. It's Belkin and all that stuff. For a long time, everyone knows that you need different kinds of people to make a team work, and that some people need to have leadership skills and some people need to have the ideas and others need to be the completer finishers and all that. Learned all about that over 20 years. Yeah, probably 25 years ago now I did my HR qualifications the first time round. So I can't believe
we've got type A people, type B people. We've got Hertzberg. We've got all these things going on in the HR psychology stuff. And
yeah,
people are people. And you're right. We need a colourful box of Lego to make the fire station, don't we?
Absolutely.
So what's the biggest challenge you're finding when you're working with organisations? Where do they need to educate most around, you know, your field, you know, the neurodiversity, the ADHD?
Neurodiversity, queerness, inclusion. Yeah. One of the challenges I've had is that they think it's a novelty, nice to have, HR hot topic kind of thing rather than something that really needs a lot of thought. So it was, to me, I noticed it gathering a lot of momentum before the pandemic. And then with the pandemic, we started to think about a lot more about the whole self to work and psychological safety. So this is turning up to work. And if you're having issues because your kids are at home and they're anxious and you're trying to do a job at home school at the same time and there's a global pandemic, that you're not just putting on a brave face and only showing a professional veneer, but you can actually say what you're up against and know that it's not going to be used against you. But then we had the Black Lives Matter movement and we've had Me Too. And it just seems like the businesses are kind of latching on to the current big thing and putting a lot of resources into that and then forgetting about the other stuff. And any kind of disability, neurodiversity, accessibility, that stuff's bubbling away, but it never seems to be particularly high on an agenda. So what I would like to see is that people realise that your workforce is neurodiverse. Even if you think you don't have any autistic employees, and every company will, but every workforce is neurodiverse because it is made up of human individuals who think, feel and process in different ways. So what we need to be doing is working out how to accommodate each individual so that they can thrive in their roles and that it isn't some nice to have, it isn't some tokenistic tick box exercise. It's just about ensuring that you've got employee engagement and that everyone's doing a good job and that people aren't leaving in droves, that they're not having a lot of time off with work-related stress or depression, but everyone is okay and doing the best work they can. And it's really not about doing nice things for disabled people. It's the right thing to do and it's good for business because you've got employees who are engaged, they're doing good work. It's going to keep you out of tribunals. It's an absolute no-brainer to me. Let's treat adults in the workforce like adults who can have needs and preferences and should be safe to voice them. Let's take them seriously. Let's meet their needs so they can thrive in their roles. It's good for everybody.
Not so much today, but in the past, I've seen branding, for want of a better way to describe it, branding neurodiverse people. And there's superpower. We don't like that word. Mm. So saying you need an autistic person to do that task because they will be hyperfocused. They will be able to do this. And you're almost saying, well, if you're an autistic person who isn't a mathematical genius, what's wrong with you? You know, you should be like Rain Man. And it's almost like setting people up to being the stereotype of one type of autism or
yeah,
one type of
really
neurodiversity.
Yeah, it's really unhelpful. Yeah. So even with dyslexia, I mean, GCHQ, for instance, they did a dyslexia hiring program because dyslexic people apparently have superpowers of pattern recognition and code cracking and all that. Not all of them, I'm sure. It's great to acknowledge the strengths that can come with each neurotype, but they're always going to be individual to the employee, to the person.
So, yeah, I mean, that would be my take on some of this, is to look into the person, into the spec you want, and not everybody who is neurodiverse, ADHD, trans, straight, non-binary, whoever you want to describe yourself, not everyone's going to fit that role for a tick box. And I think that's what we need to do, is look into the heart, but give that person the opportunity, the equity, the tools, opportunities here.
Yeah, exactly.
But don't assume. Yeah.
So let's consciously include people that have been previously excluded. Let's break down barriers to inclusion and success, dismantle some systemic barriers, and give everyone the chance to show what they can do, how they can contribute. But the other thing is, though, all humans have got value, even if they don't have a job. So it isn't all about how many of us are in the workforce.
Yeah, it is. And I think you're right there. It is. And it's also around creating aspiration, belief, trust in the process. Because a lot of when you're not atypical, you're on that middle of the line, you tend to see other people who are more capable. Your imposter syndrome kicks in. You don't see anybody else doing it. The language around the job role or the job spec doesn't shout out to you that they care about you. So we're actually creating barriers just in the language, the employer branding, the recruitment marketing we're putting out there, not just some of the other things. So we turn people off.
It needs a real big overhaul. And you see so many job descriptions even now that expect people to work autonomously and part of a team, to communicate effectively at all levels, and what other bullshit is there?
Yeah. Now, what does that mean?
Do you want to roll in a fast-paced environment? I read that and think, no, that means they're understaffed and badly managed and it's overwhelming. That's not for me. Dynamic and fast-paced, they want young people that are full of energy that they can lean on more and put more pressure on. It's ageist.
Yeah, some of that, as you say, ages, some of that is gender coded as well.
Yeah.
Neurotypical coded, as you say, there's a whole lot of dynamics in those bland statements that we've just been cutting and pasting.
Culture can mask racism as well. And good fit for culture. Is your culture that you all go down the football on a Saturday afternoon and then talk about it on a Monday? How many people is that going to exclude? Does it actually mean that you have better productivity or better innovation? I don't think so,
Culture-fit
hiring is the best way to prevent innovation.
I'm a person who's teetotal. I don't drink anymore. So talk about going to the pub or even putting on dinners where alcohol is a major part of it. I'm also doing weight management. So wanting to go out for a meal and have alcohol is like a double turn-off. And it's like, and there are many people out there, certainly the younger generation, whose lives don't revolve around alcohol and eating anymore. But that's a very old-school human thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So I have a complicated relationship with alcohol, and it's generally not great to say you're only part of the team if you can go and work hard and play hard, because I will drink too much to cope with the difficult social situation and difficult sensory situation, and then have all kinds of anxiety about how I might have come across, what wrong thing I might have said to the wrong person, and I just wake up full of dread. It's so unnecessary.
I've got that t-shirt myself. That's one of the things that I realized, that I was focusing on drinking too much because I didn't know how to have fun or how to interact without the alcohol. And then I took the alcohol away and then found that actually, I don't want to be in this environment anyway. I don't like it. It's like, what if I want to be here with the drunk people?
Yeah.
It's no fun.
So now I'm self-employed. It's great because I just work in a way that suits me. If someone says, can we go out for a drink? I want to pick your brains about a work thing. I'll say, absolutely not, but I'll go for a walk with you. Then I'm having a side-eye conversation whilst out in the countryside. I'm not sitting across the table from somebody feeling awkward.
Yeah. I don't mind a coffee. I don't mind a decaf coffee, but I'm not I now self-exclude from alcohol-focused events and food-focused events because I'm no good with either of those. I eat too much if it's in front of me, and I'll drink too much if it's there. So
I find a big sit-down meal really quite stressful with a lot of people. It's mostly the noises, the competing noises. You know, someone's trying to talk to me, but I'm hearing 10 conversations at once. So I don't do that anymore.
There's also an expectation to join into the conversation. Actually, sometimes my brain just wants to shut off and zone out, eat my dinner, and stare into space. I'm quite happy with that sometimes. But I feel obliged to talk to you, then I feel obliged to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then feel obliged to contribute to the... And I think, when I was drinking, it was fine because the alcohol just kicked in and kept me bubbly. But now it's like, sorry, you're all boring, Mick. I don't mean that rudely, but I'm just not interested in having a small talk conversation anymore. And I feel so much happier not.
Yeah. It's great, isn't it, when you can identify what makes you tick and what's a massive drain, and just decide what's worth doing and what you're not going to do anymore.
Yeah. I mean, again, you've met Marie, my wife. She has some social anxiety, exaggerated by menopause and COVID and isolation. But when you engage her in a networking situation, she is brilliant. She'll work the room. She'll form conversations. She'll go up to people who are complete strangers and sell or share. And I just can't do that. I can do it, but it's not my comfort zone. I just want to go. I'm going to sneak off now.
It's outside of my comfort zone as well. You know, I'm quite confident when I'm talking about things I know about, but small talk is horrendous. That Futurist ND accessible design event I mentioned, I offered to help with that. And one of the things that needed to be done is meeting people in reception and going up the lift with them to the conference room. And I was just so tongue-tied and awkward. It was ridiculous. But I wanted to help. So I volunteer to do things and then think, oh, this isn't me at all. But I can get up on a stage in front of 1,000 people and deliver a speech, and I'll answer questions as well, unprepared, you know, off the hoof. And I'm completely fine with all of that. But going up a couple of floors in a lift with someone who I'm expected to make polite small talk to, no, that's so out of my comfort zone. But I take a friend with me to networking.
Yeah.
If you've already got someone there with you, then it's easier to talk to additional people. So that's why you see me and my friend Lucy Hobbs going everywhere together.
Yeah, I do like a buddy at those sort of events, but I found the danger is if I'm there with somebody I know and they're not particularly bothered about networking, we'll just talk to each other.
Yeah.
We won't actually do anything else. So you think, well, what are we here for? You know, I forced myself into this environment. And now neither of us want to be here. So we go now, shall we? We sort of sneak off. But which is why I like taking Marie with me.
You want to leave stupidly early, but without having to do a lot of goodbyes and reasons why. So just like quietly slink off and then send people a text saying, I've gone.
sorry. I realised my train was coming and off. Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a thing. You go in the entire room 5 times, never quite get saying goodbye.
It's so freeing, to be honest, though, I think. When you feel safe to actually give people the real reason and you don't think they're going to mock you for it, it's so liberating. I got invited to a wedding and the person realised she'd invited way too many people. She said, would you mind if you and Si just come to the evening do and not the daytime? And I said, do you know what? Neither of us really like weddings. Do you mind if we don't come at all? And she said, thank you so much for your honesty. Yeah, that's absolutely fine. And I thought, we've travelled to this wedding, spent a fortune, had a miserable time, probably had a row when we got back to the hotel. One sentence of honesty with someone that respects me for my honesty, and we were spared all that.
Yeah, I mean, I find these days, because people are more aware of these attributes and traits of people, I'm just quite comfortable saying, look, my introvert nature is saying my batteries are flat. I've had too much. You've burnt me out. I've got no more energy to give you. So I need to go and recharge. Yeah. Sorry, I'm off now.
Yeah, and I've run out of spoons. Yeah.
Often people say to me, wish I could go as well. You know, could we sneak off together? But I'm more than okay with having one-to-ones or small conversations with people that's not small talk. It's good talk. in very intimate conversation. I could, like we're talking now, I could talk to you all day, one to one, and maybe even three of us, maybe I could do. But anything more than that, where it becomes frequent, you have to really try to make it happen. It's like, I'm done now. It's like, bye.
Yeah. It's meant to be interesting and fun, isn't it? Having a conversation, not some kind of test of your interpersonal skills.
It's like Game of Thrones networking, isn't it? Last person standing. Charlie, it's been an absolute pleasure having a chat with you. I can't believe we've been nattering away now for just over an hour.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Yeah, thank you for being so open, so honest, and sharing
You're
with
welcome.
Everybody. How can people get hold of you?
So you'll find me on LinkedIn under Charlie Hart or Awesome Charlie. Awesome with an AU for autistic, because I'm openly autistic. Same thing on Facebook and Instagram, but I may well leave them. Who knows? I've got a website. Guess what? It's www.awesomecharlie.co.uk and a YouTube channel as well. That's about it.
And let me guess, that's Awesome Charlie.
An AU. I'm on Blue Sky. So I've still got an account on Shitter with an X, as I call it now, but I don't use it. I just don't want someone to take over my handle. But I'm on Blue Sky as well, which is like that, but it's way friendlier and more inclusive. But yeah.
I'll stick all of that in the show notes underneath this, and you're going to send, you're going to signpost a resource, won't you? Which I'll.
ADHD brain can't remember what it was right now. Oh, monotropism. Yes, I will.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anything that's in there, I'll share in the notes, and then
it's the attention tunnels that give us the flow where we can really, really get into our expertise and change the world. Really,
if I'm really honest, I can't remember what you said you were going to give me either. I just knew you said something. I play along and see if it becomes obvious after a while. But yeah, it's you learn that about yourself sometimes that you don't have to remember everything. You just have to have coping mechanisms.
My favourite ADHD advocate, Dr. Ned Hallowell, he says, my thoughts are like butterflies. They're beautiful, but they fly away. So that's my brain. Yeah, they do come back eventually.
Yeah, well, you know they're there somewhere. You just got to hunt them down, haven't you? You get your net out and try and catch them. Charlie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and part to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappened.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.